We're back on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. It all comes down to tonight. Canada looking to get that gold medal on home ice in front of a absolutely electric Halifax crowd. Some others there that got to experience it live in person is Scott Wheeler, NHL draft and prospects writer at The Athletic and author of On the Clock, Behind the Scenes with the Toronto Maple Leafs at the NHL Draft. Wheelsy, what a night last night.
We keep having these in Halifax. There have been a lot of nights. It's been this tournament has been great. I wrote it last night that as far as the hockey goes, this has been scripted about as well as you could hope for. The crowds have been, as you said, electric. The games have been unbelievable. The parity in the tournament, for all the talk of that parity being less than it usually is without the Russians, the parity in this tournament has been tremendous. There have been several upsets. The great players have been the great players, whether it was David Yurecek and Yuri Kulich coming up big for Chechia last night, their two best prospects, or Connor Bedard again and again and again, although, frankly, not last night. Last night was really the first Canadian game where Connor Bedard wasn't clearly head and shoulders the best player on the ice for them. So that was a bit of a storyline coming in. They finally got some depth scoring and some big moments from others. So it's been great. Now we get the rematch of the Boxing Day upset between Canada and Chechia. And these Czechs have earned everything in this tournament. They've been legitimately a cup contender from day one. And it should be a really, really good game tonight.
Yeah, so much to dig into, but I found myself thinking about the crowd when I woke up this morning and how amazing that atmosphere was. How does it compare to the barns you've been into, the atmospheres you've witnessed? Is that at the top of the list?
As good as I've seen. Certainly that game the other night where Connor scored in overtime against Slovakia, that was truly unbelievable in there. It was deafening. But even last night, the crowd, when Thomas Milic was named player of the game for Canada, how loud it was for Milic. You could see it on his face that he really couldn't believe that this was his moment and that they were chanting for him. So it's been great. And it's probably a signal to Hockey Canada that this should be, when it's on Canadian soil, this should be the formula. It was a record crowd last night at Scotiabank Center here in Halifax, well over 10,000. The capacity is just almost exactly 10,000 in the building, and they were pushing 11 last night, and that works. That's what this is all about. It's about these communities that don't get this as often as they should. Packing a junior rink, it clearly has not worked in NHL rinks in Edmonton and Toronto and Montreal and Vancouver. But these communities that get it, where it's their biggest event of the year and nothing happens in this town that's on this scale, that's what this should be about moving forward. So I'm looking forward to them maybe going back to some non-NHL communities for this.
Yeah, the only complaints that I have seen is that the ice was really, really bad. They had to take those extended breaks during the intermission. Is that the kind of look up close and personal? The puck was bouncing. The guys seemed a little bit frustrated with the quality of the ice, maybe because it's just too warm?
Yeah, it's honestly been brutal. And not just because they played three games. I think that was the biggest part of it yesterday, where the second relegation game was also here, obviously. And as a result, they had to play three games on this ice for the second time, because they had a game with relegation the other night. But it's been like that since the beginning. I entered the rink on Boxing Day, and I could not believe how warm it was in this rink. Calling back to Ottawa for the bubble tournament and then for the summer tournament, that rink was borderline freezing, and for the better. And you don't even need a jacket in this rink. It doesn't even feel frigid. So that's been a major, major, major issue. I think the ice is going to be terrible again today. I'm sure they were working on it all night last night, but it just gets, by the time the periods are over, it just is really, really sloppy out there.
Well, it seemed to not affect Thomas Milic, who just seems to be unfazed by everything, especially considering being this undrafted player. He's becoming the storyline other than Connor Bedard, I think, throughout this Canadian tournament. Maybe a legendary-type performance, and that's what the best thing about the World Juniors is. Sometimes these unsung heroes come up and they have their moment. I don't know if it's enough to be goaltender of the tournament, but certainly he's someone to rally behind, and as you mentioned, the team seems to absolutely love him.
Oh, definitely. He's been great. He's sort of saved them on a number of occasions. That game last night was not a 6-2 hockey game. It played a lot closer to that. I don't think the score was reflective of the way that the Americans brought it, especially early. And he's been great. He's been great in big moments. Obviously, the stretch glove save that saved them in overtime against Slovakia and would have prevented this tournament from going in a completely different direction for this Canadian team. So it was a big question mark coming in. Ben Gaudreau then has a really rough night against the Czechs on Boxing Day. Ben was their goalie at U18 Worlds in Texas when they won it a couple of years ago, and Milic was the backup there. So I think they were hoping that Ben was going to grab the net and be the guy again in this tournament. And that just wasn't the case. And then it was up to Milic to step up, and he has. And really, that's the Canadian story at this tournament for a lot of years now, where they haven't had the true sort of star goalie prospects in the tournament. The Yaroslav Askarovs, the Jesper Wallstedts, the Spencer Knights. Those goaltenders have typically belonged to other countries, but they've still had some nice performances in recent tournaments. And Dylan Garand was obviously great for them in the summer. Devin Levi was tremendous for them. Joel Hofer 3 years ago was really good for them. And now Thomas is in the conversation for goaltender of the tournament in a tournament that doesn't have one of those Spencer Knights or Wallstedts or Askarov this time around. So it's kind of up for the taking, and it feels like it could be Milic's at this point.
Yeah, it almost seems that training camp extends into the tournament every year for Canada, where they have to figure out their goaltending situation on the fly. And I guess they have Czechia to thank, really, for at least looking or making Ben Gaudreau look beatable in that game. I know Milic would have had that opportunity to showcase his stuff, but it gave Milic the chance to outperform his counterpart. And of course, he's taken the ball and he's run with it. Is there any player, do you think, at the World Juniors who has improved their standing from an NHL perspective, NHL futures perspective, than Thomas Milic, who was undrafted and now I'm sure has the attention of a lot of teams?
Well, certainly he's high on that list. There have been several standouts, not among the big names. Obviously, David Jiříček has been tremendous. He's a big name, though, for Czechia. And Yuri Kulich is a first-round pick of the Buffalo Sabres, who's been brilliant for them and will be on the media all-star team as one of the three forwards, I would expect. But there have been some smaller names. Stanislav Zvozil, another Columbus Blue Jackets prospect, has been outstanding, really, really outstanding for that Czechia team. Him and David Spacek and David Jiříček have kind of formed a three-headed monster. They've been three of the best defensemen in this tournament. They've all played on the same team. Ludvig Jensen of the Florida Panthers has been the leading scorer for a Sweden team that has up front been really uninspiring. And really for the second straight tournament, it was Emil Andre in the summer tournament, the Philadelphia Flyers D prospect, who was their best player and leading scorer back in Edmonton. So Jensen's a fourth round pick who's really emerged here. And some of the goaltenders beyond Milic, the Thomas Sukaniks, another undrafted kid who's playing in the CHL. He's in the conversation as goaltender of the tournament as well for Czechia. Gabriel Struch, who's another overager, another 19-year-old who's in his last crack in the CHL at getting drafted, has been one of the best forwards for Czechia. So there have been some really nice stories. I was also really happy to see Joshua Waugh have a huge night last night, especially on the penalty kill for Canada. He was kind of joking with me after the game that in Sherbrooke and St. John in the QMJHL in his Q career, he's never penalty killed. And that was the difference for Canada. A couple of unbelievable shifts on the PK for him last night, including the empty netter late to seal it. So was a kid who was a fourth-round pick of the Montreal Canadiens, but coming up was a true sort of superstar prospect that everybody was talking about at 13, 14 years old. He played on a Chevalier team in minor hockey that went undefeated. They had a sort of miracle season that was making headlines, even though it was a minor hockey team over there, because they were 30-0, and he was this future number one pick. And now he's starting to look like the top prospect that he did growing up. And it looks like the Montreal Canadiens have a steal there. So there have been some really nice stories that way.
Yeah, Joshua Waugh last night was certainly one that impressed. And I think, as you mentioned, Montreal Canadiens fans are probably super pumped to see that, especially at the big stage and in a big game. But Fantilli also got his moment. And I saw your tweet about how, you know, he probably hasn't had maybe the best of opportunities this time, gets put on the fourth line. It's also the Connor Bedard narrative all the time. So I think we're in agreement that it was nice to see him have a moment at the big game in a big stage to get himself out there, and maybe that helps build some momentum into tonight's.
Yeah, I think when he was playing in the top six early on, it just looked like he was forcing it, like he felt he needed to score and needed to be the guy offensively, and as a result he was trying to do a little bit too much. And once he got moved down the lineup into more of a sort of energy checking role, I think that's really benefited him. He's played actually quite well despite only playing sort of 10 to 13 minutes a night. He's been all over it. He's such a brilliant skater for his size, and that truly is one of his standout qualities. And when he's playing on that fourth line, he just gets to race around out there and chase the game and forecheck and play physical and then make plays with his speed when there are opportunities for them. And I think he's been great in that role, and it was coming. He pounded one off the post on a one-timer earlier in the game. And just for him to have that big moment, for him to sort of replant his flag a little bit, he's obviously had just a remarkable season in his own right, record-chasing season, the best freshman year in college hockey that we've seen since Jack Eichel. So he's legit. He's special, and that's been lost in Connor Bedard. I'm sure it hasn't been easy for people like him and Shane Wright to spend every single availability, every single day, just answering questions about Bedard over and over again. They've been happy to do it. They've handled it really well because Bedard is Bedard, and I'm sure they're thrilled for him. But that can't be, from an ego perspective and all of that, can't be the easiest thing in the world either for them. And so for him to get his moment, Shane hasn't yet quite really had his. Maybe that comes tonight when it matters most. But for Adam to get his moment, I'm sure was special for him.
So we'll get to the rematch and the full circle close at this tournament and the gold medal match between Czechia and Canada in a moment. But I think we should look back at the U.S.-Canada semifinal for a second, or at least hang on it. How do you categorize that win for Canada? Was that about survival? Was that coming into their own? Like, what's your main takeaway from how that game played out and where it leaves Canada as it shoots into the gold medal final here today?
I think my main takeaway was that that's what this Canada team was designed to look like. I thought their defense really struggled, and I think the Canadian brass would probably agree with that assessment. There were moments in that game where this big, big D that Canada has assembled looked a little bit overwhelmed with the pace and forechecking and speed of the American forwards. So that, if anything, I think will be what Czechia looks to exploit as well. And that's how Czechia exploited them early on in the opener. So it was really the only snafu in last night's game. Otherwise, they looked like they were supposed to look at the start of the tournament, where the top six is the top six they're creating. Even though Shane Wright and Dylan Gunther in that second line didn't finish last night, they had several chances. Shane had some really good looks. Shane's been, frankly, snake-bitten. He also hit a crossbar against Slovakia. Dylan Gunther is second on the team to Connor Bedard in shots on goal in this tournament, and despite having scored a bunch on the power play, hasn't been able to bury one, but feels like he has one coming at even strength. And other than that, the bottom six was heavy. They relied heavily on Zach Ostapchuk and Nathan Gauthier and Zach Dean. That third line played a lot late. They played actually in the second and third period, they played more than the Bedard line or any other line. And then that fourth line with Owen Beck inserted onto it in place of Reed Schaefer and Caden Banker and Adam Fantilli, they were great. And it just allowed Canada to play sort of a heavier game. And that's what they wanted to do coming into this tournament. So if they can get a performance like that again, that's what this Team Canada wanted to be about. They didn't want it to just be the Bedard show and be a one-line team coming in. So if they can get contributions from those guys and a contribution like they did last night, even from Brant Clark, who's a returnee from the NHL and may not go back to the NHL, but had made a strong case with Los Angeles before this tournament. That was a big moment for him. So it was the first sort of game that looked like Team Canada, and it still wasn't perfect. It wasn't pretty. They could have easily lost that game to the U.S., But it's a very strong American team, and Canada got contributions from just about everybody in the end.
So how do those teachings or learnings or realizations help them in the rematch versus Czechia? Like if you're recalibrating after, I guess, what was a bit of a shock loss in the opener, in what ways do you think Canada has improved or learned in order to be better, to get the better result?
I think it just allows Dennis Williams to let the game breathe a little bit more. There have been times in this tournament where Dennis felt like he didn't have those other lines going, and as a result, we were seeing way too much of Connor Bedard, debatably. In that Slovakia game, Connor was playing 2-minute shifts. He was out every other shift. They were taking timeouts specifically to get him back out there. I think last night that wasn't the case at all. That first line of Bedard, Roy, and Stankoven played a lot in the first half, and then in the second half when Canada had the lead, they were going to the Gaucher line a lot more, and Bedard was sat on the bench a lot late in the game last night. So they need that. They need to not feel like they have to rely strictly on one line, and I think that's the biggest takeaway from last night, is that Dennis is going to feel a lot more comfortable after seeing how that bottom six played. He's going to feel a lot more comfortable just rolling them over the boards one after another. And then if Canada can come in waves and stay fresh, I think that'll make a big difference tonight.
If Czechia is able to assert itself, resist those waves, prevent things from going snowballing, what is it going to look like? Czechia at its best, and it's been maybe at its best throughout this tournament. What does it look like when that team is functioning the way it can?
Well, I think it looks like having the better goalie on the ice and having better players at other positions as well. I think there's a chance tonight, if Connor Bedard isn't brilliant, that they have the best forward, best defenseman, and best goalie in the game. And really, they've got three of the best, as I mentioned earlier, off the top, three of the best defensemen in this tournament. So this Czech team is no joke. They've got excellent players at all positions. David Jiříček is a true star prospect, a better prospect than any of the seven that Canada has on its defense. Stanislav Zvozil, I mentioned, has been brilliant, and he plays and knows Connor Bedard as well as anybody because they're teammates in Regina. I expect that you'll see a lot of spot check in Zvozil against Bedard and Stankoven tonight, and he'll be keen to shut down his teammate in Regina. But they've also had great depth. They've got a third line, this Czech team, of Gabriel Struč, Jakub Brabinic, who's a Vegas Golden Knights prospect, and Yaroslav Halash, who is a New York Rangers prospect. And that third line has been the best depth line in this tournament. They've been just impossible to stop on the forecheck for all of their opponents. So they've got star power. Their depth guys have played the best hockey of their careers. And as a result, they're a very, very good team. But I still think the only way Canada loses a game in this tournament, and it's the big reason they lost the opener to the Czechs, is discipline. And I think that above anything else is what Canada has learned over the course of this tournament, is they just cannot get into penalty trouble. Canada often has that big hit where they hit somebody too hard, right? And under IHF rules, it costs them a 5-minute major and then they lose and get upset in tournament. That's usually the storyline. That or goaltending is usually the storyline in this tournament. And I don't think it's going to be goaltending that's the undoing at this point. So if they're going to lose this game tonight, I think it's going to come down to discipline, them getting too hot in front of the crowd in that moment. These are teenagers. It's easy to get out of control and make a mistake because you're not thinking in the moment. And they've done a good job of staying disciplined. So that's got to be the key tonight, is just stay out of the box. I think that's the only way they lose this game, because they should be the better team at 5-on-5.
Well, it'd certainly be the perfect bookend, defeating the team that upset you to start the tournament on home ice. I can't wait to see how tonight unfolds. But before we let you go, we were talking about the NHL All-Star Game vote and how they're allowing for fans to really get whoever you want in there with your fan vote. Who would be your John Scott of this year?
Oh, who are the great stories around those? That's an excellent question. I don't know. I love the personalities. So whether Trevor Zegras and those types of guys have earned it or not, I'd love to see Trevor involved in this game and showcasing himself. Obviously, we saw a glimpse of it last year, and Anaheim's had a tough go of it. But Trevor is, a real light in the league, all of the kids from that American team are just full of that American age group that went through the National Development Program with Trevor Zegras are full of energy. I love those kids and the sort of how they are themselves, whether that's Trevor or or Cole in Montreal or Jack Hughes. All of those guys have a ton of personality. I'm sure all three of those guys would love to be there together. And it's not outside the realm of possibility that all three of those guys deserve to be there. Mm-hmm. So that's in terms of guys in the, around the league that I just I've really enjoyed getting to know over the years and that have a ton of personality. And that's what this should be all about. I think Caulfield, Zegras, and Hughes come to mind, and they all train together in the summer, and they're lifelong friends. So that, I think that would be a ton of fun.
Well, it'd be great for the highlights, for the Instagram reels to see those guys out there, because they just make things happen that is beyond our wildest imagination. I totally appreciate you coming on bright and early this morning, especially with a big day ahead, Scott. So enjoy the gold medal game, and hopefully we chat about a good victory for our boys here in the red and white.
Thanks, guys. Should be fun.
Thanks so much. That's Scott Wheeler, NHL Draft Prospects writer at The Athletic and author of On the Clock, Behind the Scenes with the Toronto Maple Leafs at the NHL Draft, which you can check out wherever you get your books.
The Americans may have the personality, but we have the gold medals.
Good one. Wow. Don't jinx it. You just, happiness hedge for you tonight with your Chechia future on tonight's game. Speaking of that, send in your wake and rake picks for tonight. Obviously, you got the gold medal matchup between Canada and the Czech Republic or the Chechia team now. And Maple Leafs in action back at home against the Seattle Kraken on a little homestand here before they get another one on Friday night and then a back-to-back on the road against the Flyers. So lots of Maple Leafs hockey ahead. Send in your picks at 590-590. We'll put you in the wake and rake. Wanted to cycle through a couple more of those NHL All-Star suggestions.
Sure.
From the John Scott narrative. Multiple people saying, not a Flyers fan, but Travis Konecny is having a great season, especially for my fantasy team. That was Uncle Joel and also Dan from Collingwood. Two big votes for him.
A little random.
Well, because you said who
I guess,
from Philly
we were,
would.
Yeah, we were trying to figure out if it was going to be Sanheim going. That's the problem, though. Like, Konecny hasn't had an all-star year. Like, I maybe he's surprising with what he's done. I'll pull up his numbers now. But when you have to have representation from every team, you get players that are having
well, he's got 37 okay points in 32 games.
That's a good season. 19 goals. That's, hey, I circled Konecny. I'm not sure if we brought it up or I brought it up last week, but he'd be a good ad for the Leafs. He's like Michael Bunting. If you want to add another Michael Bunting, he's Michael Bunting with maybe a little bit more natural offensive ability. So that'd be great. But the fact of the matter is it's probably going to be Konecny, and you're going to be like, the average is going to be like, eh, who's that? What does he do? What's his season doing? What's it like? Mm. Oh, he's got 19 goals. That's nice for him.
Mike from Assiniboia, Nick Ritchie.
Oh, who's going for Arizona? I guess it could be Chychrun because he's played really, really well since coming back.
It's kind of boring, though.
It probably has to be Chychrun.
Kiprios don't they have
is talking
some young
yesterday.
Pups, though?
I mean, Clayton Keller goes every year, but he's not. He's going to be like, he's going to break a record for all-star appearances, and he might not have any really earned on merit.
You know who it's going to be? Nick Ritchie, Travis Boyd, and any other Leaf that ever
That's
was
true.
A Leaf will all be going.
Kipper brought up Lawson Crouse as the potential impact ad for the Maple Leafs on Kipper and Bourne yesterday. If it's going to be Crouse, though, and you got to give up a guy like Matthew Nyes, I mean, the one-stop shop could be Arizona. I know that they don't have much, but if you could get Chychrun and Crouse in the big deal where you're putting all the chips into the middle of the table, they're both cost-controlled. Arizona can retain salary if they so choose. If you want to give them your entire prospect capital, that might be the deal. That might be the destination to make the deal. Mm-hmm. Interesting that
I think they'd be interested.
Lawson Crouse came out of Kipper's mouth yesterday.
I can't believe we missed this one, but Hot Dog Phil to the All-Star game.
Yeah. Yeah. That's always.
You don't want Phil the Thrill there?
I mean, no. I like Phil, but he's not an all-star.
Yeah, but he's a personality.
Not, is he, though? Or do people just like...
He is in our
like
hearts.
...like to project a personality on him? Or make fun of him without really making fun of him?
JVR is in Philly. That's Rob from downtown.
Yeah, former Leaf angle. Not an all-star.
Well, we've got someone on board for the William Nylander.
Mercifully, I think that contract expires this summer for JVR. Mm. Not a good deal.
We have someone on board for our justice for William Nylander. Neil from Collingwood says, William Nylander deserves to go to the All-Star game. He's often overshadowed by Marner Matthews, but he's having a hell of a year. You're right in.
Yep.
Speaking, preacher to the choir here, Neil.
That's what we were talking about yesterday. It's going to be maybe the hardest path in the league to an All-Star game. He is at that level where, if he has a good year, he should be in consideration, but he plays with two of the best players on the planet, and it's going to be really hard to outshine them. But in my opinion, he has this year. So send him.
All right.
Justice for Willie.
You heard it here first. We're going to take a break. We've got to get back into evaluating and just trying to break down that Raptors performance last night. Maybe the weirdest game that we've ever watched.
It's a good thing we got Katie on.
Katie's level-headed. She knows. Katie Heindel next on the Fan Morning Show with Ailish and Justin.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back on the Fan Morning Show. Sports at 590 The Fan, Justin and Ailish. It's Baby Friday, everyone. Which always means the vibes are high. We're trying to sustain that level of enthusiasm when we talk about our next topic, which is the Toronto Raptors. But someone that always brings the positivity and the vibes is Katie Heindel, NBA writer at Dime, Slam Magazine, and Yahoo Sports Canada. How's it going this morning, Katie?
Good. No pressure, guys. Yeah, good morning.
Only the best, please. We have to find something tangible. That was the weirdest sporting event I think I've watched in my entire existence. You were there. You got to see it in person, the tale of two different games. Like, where do you even begin to unpack in a performance such as that?
It was wild, I have to say. The amount of times I kind of checked out and checked back in, and I think literally that is what 20% of the crowd did in the fourth quarter, and you can't necessarily blame them. It's tough. It is like a tale. It's almost like this crystallization kind of tale of two teams that we have struggled with this season. When you kind of look at a team that drags, it doesn't always know where it's going offensively, can't get the spark. But then when you have these kind of glorious, energizing comebacks where it seems like, oh, right, these are also the same guys where it feels like watching them at times, anything is and can be possible. And then that kind of nosedives.
No, that's exactly how we tried to unpack it this morning as well. Is it felt like the entire Raptors season rolled up into one performance, the ups, the downs, the frustrations, and then the boosts of enthusiasm and excitement. And I'm sure being there was a roller coaster ride of emotions as well. But before we get into trying to talk about part one versus part two, you mentioned that you wanted to come on here and defend Fred VanVleet. So your platform has presented itself. Where is the pathway to defending Fred VanVleet in your mind?
Here's the floor for me, finally. thank you. I'll take it. Okay, so I think I get the need for a scapegoat emotionally at this point in the season. I do, for this team, for the way that they've been playing, for what's going on. But rationally and by the numbers, there is not one. And when I say by the numbers, you got to look at last night. This team is 9 out of 46 from deep, 38 field goals out of 116 attempts. Fred VanVleet is not that prolific. That's a team effort. So that's probably the first thing. And I also think, this is the guy who kept his team in a very strange game that they did not necessarily seem to even want to be in for the first three quarters, but he kept them in, and you don't get to overtime or even a shot at overtime without that. I think, and you probably talked about this, but the last play at overtime, I think it showed some defensive ISO, maybe hero ball, and you kind of squander what was such an exciting sequence to get there. That stings. But again, that lack of effort and that offensive energy across the board is what has lost the team the game. And, Fred said after the game, he doesn't look at the numbers game to game. He looks at his season averages. I went back and did look at those averages. He is on track, even in the slump of this season, I don't even know if we can call it a slump anymore. Maybe this is a season, regardless, to hit or to pass those numbers. And that was his all-star season, you know, assists, rebounding, scoring. It is all on par. And there has to be a level of credibility, I think, given to leaders like Fred, who have always taken responsibility and shouldered the bad with the good. Like, he is someone who he wears the losses, like, on his sleeve. He always does. He doesn't come in and make excuses. He doesn't come in and say, like, I mean, I saw some people saying, like, oh, it was an excuse last night, being like, it felt weird. But if you were watching that game, you didn't have to be in the arena. It did feel weird. It was a very weird game. It was very weird for the Bucks too. So I don't really understand placing him kind of squarely as scapegoat for that as well, because to me, if you're like rationally trying to throw someone under the bus, if that's possible, mm-hmm. it's probably someone who doesn't kind of look earnestly at what they've done and say, like, all right, my bad, that's on me, at least once. And I think Fred VanVleet, again, is somebody who does that all of the time. At some point, like myself, you do run out of answers and explanations, because this is a team that we've talked about before, last season is the same on paper as this season, if not, was supposed to be a little bit better on paper this season than last season. So what is the explanation for it? And again, like, you can't blame him for not always having the answers.
I mean, you lay out a lot of great points, and I think that's the frustration with this team is we don't have a lot of answers. And last night, with the tale of two games, it provided maybe some insight into the team that they might really be and the team that we hope that they would have been on two ends of the game. So let's start with part one. To start, just possibly the worst ESPN performance. I thought that they maybe would never put the national spotlight on the Raptors again. I mean, on both sides of the court, it was pretty tough. I don't even know if there's an answer to this, but is it like a vibe that starts that type of slump? Is it, can we just pinpoint shooting? Like, why on earth were both teams just so abysmal to start the game? Is there an actual answer to that, or just another part of the mystery?
I mean, some of that is like the mystery of basketball. And I think this is just something like energy can be very catching. Mm-hmm. You know, you see that in like the good times as well as the bad. I don't know that I've seen it to that extent that it becomes like catching for both teams, and that they both seem to be like bogged down or just like allergic to shots falling. And this is like in and out shots. Like, these are like so many shots for the Bucks, I will say. I'll give them more credit than the Raptors for like that first half of the game. But like, could not like buy a bucket, really. And it was even like many times looking up at the shot clock or the scoreboard and being like, oh, right, we're in overtime. Still no one is at 100. Like, that to me is kind of like the overarching thing of it. This whole thing about like the NBA is all about offense kind of goes out the window with that game. Maybe they're trying to prove a point. But there's really no logical explanation for it. I mean, for the Raptors, I guess, unfortunately, it is a bit more logical. These are the same problems we've been seeing for the last like month and a half now. You've got like just no offensive spark. You don't have like an offensive spark happening together. You've kind of got different guys at different points trying to pull it out and start something, and like that doesn't stick. There was a lot of trepidation. The Bucks did not have that, but the Raptors did have a lot of trepidation just in their shot selection. Even anyone like wanting to shoot, there were so many times where it just seemed like, whether it's because you don't want to be the person missing another shot on an ESPN broadcast or not, where like no one wanted to take the shot. It was just getting passed around like endlessly in a very like frustrating, kind of like badly mesmerizing way. So it the energy to me, it just got weirder, but I have to say it started fine. So I was quite confused.
Yeah. The ESPN impact's fascinating. Like, not wanting to miss the next shot. I mean, these guys are used to performing. It may not be the ESPN stage, but it's the NBA stage every night. It's fascinating that would have, or at least a perceived impact, but it's hard to say that it didn't, because that was so much weirder, as you laid out and as we talked about in the first hour, than any other game. So it's truly head-scratching. I guess part two is the comeback, and Ailish and I looked at this differently. Ailish was happy to bring up the word grit and like that the Raptors deserved it and fought back, and there's some valiance to that. I thought it was fake basketball. I thought it was a confluence of events where you know, Brooke Lopez didn't want to really give an honest effort defensively on Scotty Barnes, who did all of a sudden want to take those next shots. And Grayson Allen gets a little handsy, and Gary Trent Jr. makes a great play. And that's really the only it's the only real basketball play, I think, in that 3 minutes was Gary Trent Jr. hitting that buzzer beater. But like, it just felt completely fake to me, inauthentic. Is there anything that you take that's real from that? Especially when considering, hey, real basketball starts again, start of overtime, and the Raptors that started the first quarter are back on the court.
Yeah, I mean, I will give them some credit. I do think there was some real stuff happening. It just sort of sucks that it was all happening within, what, like 74 seconds? Like, they made up 18 points in the last, like, 74 seconds of regulation, and you had, like, them scoring 12 points in the first quarter, like, comparatively. So I would say that does take some real effort, and it took everything kind of going right that you wanted to happen all season, like Scotty Barnes finally showing some offensive engagement, whether that's because he has given himself a green light, the coaching staff has given him a green light to run some plays that serve him a little bit better at that end. Also, just like Gary Trent Jr.'s shots finally falling, especially like in the clutch moment where you need them to. Maybe that's from converting all those turnovers you force Giannis into making. I think it was like 12, which is a career record for him. You know, you're finally converting those into meaningful possessions in a very small sliver of time. But there is like finally some like offensive engagement and effort. So I can see both of your points, because I can see how it feels like, yeah, that's digging in when you need the team to. However, there is also this sense where now, like, we're seeing the potential of this team and their desperation, which is also tough, because that now seems to be where their identity is tied up. And I don't think that's a good nor like a lasting way for a team to be.
Maybe my net is a little bit, or I cast a less wide of a net, but you were the first person that really started or mentioned Nick Nurse as an issue when you came on our show.
Okay. Is this at my feet squarely, but okay.
No, I mean, it's clearly, again, you're having conversations, other people are talking about that you're seeing that I'm not seeing, but I thought it was really, really smart. And I think it's aged well, because now I'm seeing that more and more and more. So where do you see the situation with Nick Nurse now, how it's evolved, and whether a lot of these issues do lay at his feet?
I wouldn't say a lot. I mean, some do. He's the coach. There has to be, like, again, we're talking about responsibility. If we want players to take responsibility, I think it's fair to ask your head coach and the coaching staff to also take some responsibility and step in. He did seem as confounded, and you can't really lay last night's game at his feet, but he did seem as confounded as Fred VanVleet did, as the rest of us did, walking into post games. You know, like, it was a weird game. There was a weird energy there. It's difficult to coach out of that. I do still think there's something to be said for whether the discrepancy we're seeing now is not coaching to the players that you have, to their ability, if you're trying to coach to where you want them. Sometimes that's great when you have an overachieving team. This team is not overachieving. So that is where I wonder if there should be some better adjustments made. You saw the shift in Scotty. Scotty is a tough barometer because he's just a second-year player. You know, like, he's smart. I did really like when Fred, you know, gave him some credit last night. He was asked, like, whether, you know, is this too much for Scotty? He's like, I mean, he's here. He understands how to make decisions. He's still learning, but, like, you got to give him – you got to give him some like level of authority in the game. Still, you want to put him in more positions to succeed. Nick Nurse doesn't also have a lot of help on the bench right now when you've got your starters playing 46 minutes, like 46 to 45. I think Pascal just got like a breezy 40 minutes because he was in foul trouble. Mm-hmm. But there's no bench to be had right now. So there's a lot of different ways. It sounds like I'm perhaps making excuses. I'm not. I'm just trying to, like, big picture it, which is how I sort of force myself to look at this team. But when I look at the big picture, there have to be some kind of adjustments, whether that's Nurse's approach to coaching this team now, and perhaps, like, what Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster, if they're going to make some adjustments, what that is, because you're starting to see a misfit collectively. And of course, yes, on the coaching side.
I think the misfit's a perfect word, because not only is it like the way that the coach is maybe deploying the players that are available or lack of players on the bench, but the team itself and the dynamic on the court, to me, it felt like the vibes have been off for a little while here. Yesterday, there's a perfect example of this. Chris Boucher's running backwards into a screen. Nobody calls it out. He falls down. Nobody goes to get him. That's just like an easy basketball play that you should be able to say, hey, you know, watch out. But no one's dialed in. Felt like the communication has been gone a little bit on the court. And I don't know if that's a representation of coach and leadership, coach and like the way the players are responding, or just between maybe what's going on in the locker room. Is that how you're kind of seeing it as well? Is that just a one-off experience that maybe we're looking too deeply at?
No, I think there's some of that there for sure. I think some of that is getting kind of expounded on just because of the way that the team's playing. Like, you don't necessarily want to talk to any of your coworkers when you're all having a terrible time at work. And I do equate some of this to that. But like, I was chatting with some people about this at the game, when you kind of look at, and I know it's not necessarily great to be super nostalgic, but when you look back at Raptors iterations of the past, I think even way back to like Kyle and DeMar and like that team that sort of fought through some really rough seasons, there was always the sense that they're in communication, you know, the team talks to each other. You don't want to be, you don't have to be best buds with everybody, but there's like real relationships there. There's a disconnect, I think, in this team. I don't know if that's because you've lost some institutional knowledge in your veterans. Like, you've lost a lot of that core. You've lost players that made up that team identity, and you haven't necessarily gone out and tried to add on to or, you know, nurture a new team identity, really. Like, Pascal, Fred, and OG, even Chris Boucher, like, yes, they were a part of that, and they are a big part of the team identity now, but they're not, it can't just fall on them. Like, they're not enough to kind of substantiate it going forward. So that's a disconnect that you're starting to see now too. Like, we've been told that, all right, this is a team that's building. We're going to make this like homegrown, next championship run. We're going to develop. Okay. But as I said earlier, like, the team's identity now is one of desperation. And what I mean, that's like not lasting. It's like, it's not physically possible to sustain. It's also not a great look in terms of your team chemistry, you know, in your locker room and beyond that. So I think there is a disconnect in communication. I don't know. I'm not in the locker room. I'm close to it, but there's a different feeling. Maybe that's because, you know, these are still newish players, younger players, but you've lost and you haven't replaced or said, like, set the standard of like what the team identity is, you know, like there's still big Marc Gasol, Serge Ibaka, who was in the building last night, you know, Kyle Lowry size gaps. And I get, we're not going to get those back, but you feel them more now.
At the risk of conducting, you know, something of a survey of knowledgeable Raptor people, I do want to ask you a question I asked Joe Cachero yesterday. If you eliminate the context of the Raptors, like, this season is not what we know, where they could go, where they've come from, it's not relevant at all. Does Masai Ujiri running a full teardown rebuild pique your curiosity?
I like this. I got metaphysical question. no, I mean, I'm not on the rebuild team usually ever, just because I've said this before. It takes so long. It takes so long to get back to any semblance of competitiveness. I think, like, especially now, you know, I was thinking about this last night, where last time we talked about kind of long-term and big picture, you know, and how this slump wasn't so difficult to get out of. And now that slump has morphed into something deeper, but you look around the league and there's this real quagmire in the middle, like in both conferences, I'd say like 7 through 12 in the East, and almost like from the Mavs, so like 4 through 12 in the West. There's a lot of teams that are kind of scrapping it out to stay stuck, essentially, because the talent and the production of the top teams is so good. And so are the like middle and just better than middle teams. Like, it makes this harder to get out of, and it makes it much harder to get back to even above 500, you know, for this Raptors team. So if we're pretending this Raptors team doesn't exist, you still can't pretend the league doesn't exist and what's happening in the league and just this explosion of talent and teams kind of figuring out other ways to win, like that's not going to stop. It's a very accelerant league. So you blow it up, you start again. If you can't even figure out an identity to forge with this team, I question how you do that with just like fresh start, you know, like ground zero. It's if people are complaining now that this team's not much fun to watch, like, please cast your mind ahead to a time where you're like, you're looking at 5 more years of just like not even middling, much worse.
Well, we have an opportunity to find out a lot about the Raptors, especially on home court. They've got a big homestand here, and hopefully it's a determining factor of maybe which direction that we want, which direction management wants, and hopefully the players, the vibes just get a little better. Katie, I appreciate you joining us this morning. I think you did a great job of defending Fred VanVleet. We'll have you back on in a couple weeks to see where we stand with everything.
Thanks so much, guys. Appreciate it.
Chat soon, Katie. Katie Heindel, NBA writer at Dime, Slam Magazine, and Yahoo Sports Canada.
I think that's pretty important perspective. And again, it's out of the context of Raptors, but if it is scorched earth, there's no promise. And what are we going to talk about on this show for 5 years? Like, it's, yeah, I'm glad I asked the question. I think that was a great answer.
I mean, the perspective that I want to pull up here is where they were last season, because there was different expectations, don't get me wrong, but Raptors were 3 games below 500 on December 31st last year, and they're also only 31 games in the season. In order for the Raptors to repeat their total win total from last season, they need to finish the season 33-13, which is a 59-win pace right now.
That's lulling into a false sense of security.
Those are just the numbers, Justin.
This is different. Does it not look different?
It does, and it feels different. But...
and the expectations were lower. And Scotty Barnes wasn't an established entity. I guess you can argue he's not really an established entity right now, or at least there's been some... a bit of a step back, devolved to a certain extent. But... I think you got to read the situation, and the situation is different. That wasn't the expectation last year that they go on that run. That was the product of, you know, things were progressing. Things were getting better, and all of a sudden you go on a run. It is going the opposite direction, and if things just continue to trend, they trended last year. They went on a bit of an exponential rise, an exponential pace. Not to say that it'll go the other way exponentially, but I think we can follow where the trajectory is going and where that leaves the Raptors. Is not the same place that it left them last year.
Well, with this team, it's anything seems possible, right, Justin? The word itself, I'm possible, says I'm possible, impossible. Mm-hmm. And that's, as we saw in 3 minutes and 13 seconds, very hard to pinpoint what this Raptors team is and what they can be. But we do have an opportunity over the next couple of days and this month to see them quite a lot at home. So always the text line is open at 590-590. I think there's a lot of conflicting feelings about this team, which direction you want to go, how long you're willing to press the pause button before decisions are made. So I think with that said, you can always send in at 590-590 your thoughts and feelings on the Raptors, especially after last night's wild game. And while you're at it, send in your wake and rake picks at 590-590. Tonight, you've got Leafs in action and the gold medal game between Canada and Czechia to maybe pick your anchor submissions from. Obviously, no Thursday night football tonight, but we'll round up everything in the wake and rake at around 8:30. But we have Mike Kelly on the other side of the break, NHL Network analyst and analytics expert. We're going to go deep into the numbers.
Can he help us drive the William Nylander All-Star campaign?
Should.
We'll ask him.
All right, that's next on the Fan Morning Show. Justin and Ailish, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.